You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 13th, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
And we have a guest rogue this week, Phil Plait, the Bad Astronomer. Phil, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks for having me on. I've never been on this show before, and this is quite exciting.
Yeah, it's quite a novel experience, isn't it?
Wow. Oh, Phil.
Hey, Phil.
Good to have you back, man.
Yay.
Yeah, Rebecca is having computer problems. She'll join us later if she ever manages to troubleshoot, but she may be out this evening.
It's me. How many times have I done the show, and how many times have I actually done this when Rebecca's been on? It's like twice, it seems like.
Are you saying maybe your magnetic field is interfering with her magnetic field and causing some sort of issue there?
Well, it was good week then, because basically you'll be the faux Rebecca for this week.
Okay. I'm in.
But,
sure.
Don't speak in a high voice.
And put on your larger rimmed glasses.
I don't know if I have a pair of green plastic glasses or whatever she's wearing these days.
Phil, tell us what you've been up to.
Oh, just hanging out, you know. Actually, honestly, it's been pretty busy this summer. I've been writing a lot, traveling a lot, hitting some cons, giving talks, working on some secret projects I can't talk about just yet, but hopefully I'll have some news about very soon. And it's just been crazy busy.
So if there are any listeners who don't know who Phil Plait is, he is the Bad Astronomer. You could read him at you're on Slate, right? Badastronomy.com. If they just look up Bad Astronomy, you'll be the first hit.
And I'll say, coming up soon, I'm going to be at the Bad Ad Hoc Hypothesis Fest, BAH Fest, with Zach Wiener in San Francisco, where people get to come up with crazy evolutionary theories and present them to an audience, and it's all going to be very funny. So if you look up BAH Fest, that's going to be great. I can't wait for that.
Oh, cool.
That sounds cool.
So I'm going to cover this day in skepticism, since Rebecca is not here. Have you guys ever heard of Urbain Grandier?
No.
Does anybody know how to pronounce Urbain Grandier?
Don't ask me.
Is it Grandier, do you think? G-R-A-N-D-I-E-R?
Grandier.
Could be.
Grandier. Maybe you kind of swallow the R a wee bit.
Grandier.
Yeah, so he died on August 18th.
Oh, it's a person.
1634. Yeah, it's a person. He was burned alive at the stake for being...
Ooh. A newt.
A witch.
A skeptic.
A witch.
No, a warlock. I thought it was...
Men, witches, were warlocks, right?
It's true. Benny Hill reference. So,
Wow. That's reaching way back.
That's going back. Yeah. It's an interesting story. He was a priest, but didn't buy the whole celibacy thing. He actually wrote a book trying to convince the Catholic Church that
I could see that.
Yeah, priests don't really have to be, you know, the doctrine of clerical celibacy was, you know, passé and should be getting rid of. Meanwhile, he just ignored it and was known as a philanderer. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a confused story about between him and a nunnery, and the mother superior at the nunnery was interested in him, but he rebuked her. So then she, accused him of cavorting with the devil, and some of the other nuns agreed with that. So then he was put on trial. He was found innocent, but then his enemy, Cardinal Richelieu, the chief minister of France, campaigned against Grandier. He essentially reopened the trial, charged him again, and then at that point, the nuns essentially recanted their earlier testimony. They would not repeat their accusations. Didn't matter. They essentially produced a contract, a written contract between Grandier and Satan.
Wow.
Contract, I gotta read the whole thing because it's like right out of the show Supernatural. It's wonderful. This is the translated version of the contract. We, the influential Lucifer, the young Satan, Beelzebub, Leviathan, Elimi, and Astaroth, together with others, have today accepted the covenant pact of Urbain Grandier, who is ours. And him do we promise to the love of women, the flower of virgins, the respect of monarchs, honors, lusts, and powers. He will go whoring 3 days long, at the carousal will be dear to him. He offers us once in the year a seal of blood. Under the feet he will trample the holy things of the church, and he will ask us many questions. With this pact he will live 20 years happy on the earth of men, and will later join us to sin against God. Bound in hell in the council of demons, Lucifer, Beelzebub, Satan, Astaroth, Leviathan, Elimi, the seals place the devil, the master, and the demons, princes of the Lord, Balberith, writer. And
oh my,
and they presented this as a genuine document. And he was convicted. Probably they got him to confess under torture.
Yeah.
Or they just made it up. You know, he can't really tell the difference. But he did you know, profess his innocence right until they burned him alive at the stake. It really is. Any of you guys watch Supernatural, the show Supernatural?
No.
Nope. I've steered clear.
Pretty good.
It's you know, it's good mind candy. It's good, you know, it's well written. It's fun. But this is like, they used this as a source, you know, for, this is like right out of one of the episodes.
That's classic.
That's what you could do to your enemies back then. 1634. Yes. You could just decide, I don't like that guy. I'm going to get him burned at the stake for making a pact with the devil.
Oh my God. And then the nuns recanted. They didn't even join in and still.
Didn't matter.
They just make it up. Way too late for that, right?
Yeah. So Steve, you sure that he didn't make a pact with the devil though?
Yeah, you can't prove he didn't not make a pact with the devil.
I know. You have to prove that Lucifer and Beelzebub and Satan didn't really sign that document.
Now, see, Lucifer, Satan, Beelzebub, Leviathan, Elimi, I think that's all one person.
Yeah.
And then there's
Yeah.
That's the way, because it's signed.
Oh, it kind of covers all.
It's kind. Lucifer, Beelzebub, Satan. That's one signature. And then below that, Astaroth, Leviathan, Elimi. It's confusing.
Did he sign with a hoof print or anything like that?
Those may all be different people because they often signed with like their symbol, like a name. It's just like a symbol.
Well, he is legion, for he is many.
He is legion. That is true. All right. Well, hey, Phil, we got you here. Let's talk about a couple of astronomy items. I understand that NASA said something like, hey, you know what, guys? By the way, 2 years ago, civilization was almost destroyed. Carry on.
Everything's fine now.
Everything's fine. Nothing to see here.
That's not really such a horrible way of summarizing this story.
I know.
Oh, gosh.
You know, and I'm laughing about it, but it, 2 years ago, I remember when this happened, and it was like, oh, wow, the sun really, really blew off a big old blob of stuff there and didn't think anything of it. And now we're learning, and I guess it was known then, but it's starting to come out now, that in fact the solar storm was a huge event. So the sun is not just sitting there glowing hot. It has a very strong and complex magnetic field, and there's a huge amount of energy that is stored in that magnetic field. And this energy can be released. There are a couple of ways it can do this. It can do it on the surface where the magnetic field lines get very tangled up and just basically you get a tremendous and very short burst of energy. And by tremendous, I mean, you know, like millions of times the size of a nuclear weapon. It's a huge thing. And that's what we call a solar flare. That can trigger a much larger event called a coronal mass ejection, which is also a magnetic event. But basically, this will eject something like a billion tons of subatomic particles from the sun.
Now, Phil, from my reading, the relationship between like really big solar flares and coronal mass ejections is still controversial or uncertain?
Let me say that it is clear that some flares happen and then coronal mass ejections happen right after them. So CMEs, as we call them, can be triggered by flares, or they are both two aspects of the same event. But we also get flares without coronal mass ejections, and we get coronal mass ejections without flares. So they are connected in some physical way, but it's not always clear what's causing which and what's exactly happening. But in fact, the biggest event like this that was ever seen was in 1859. It was the so-called Carrington event. It was actually seen by a couple of astronomers who were observing the sun in visible light. And for a flare to be seen in visible light against the background of the sun is huge. That was a big event. And that triggered a huge coronal mass ejection. And this basically a blast of these subatomic particles went screaming across the solar system and hit the Earth. And there is an associated magnetic field sort of trapped in this plasma that moves outward with it. That affects the Earth's magnetic field. A whole series of things has to happen here. But basically, it's kind of like a sympathetic vibration in a sense. The magnetic field of this plasma cloud interacts with our magnetic field and can generate a huge amount of electric current in the Earth itself, under the ground. This is called a geomagnetically induced current. That can cause a lot of damage. Back then, in 1859, it caused telegraphs to short out. There were places where the telegraph batteries were basically turned off, but there was so much electricity flowing through the lines with the batteries turned off because of this event. Basically, it was creating electric current in the Earth that telegraphs could work, even though they were, you know, in a sense, switched off. It's bizarre. And we've been saying for years, if this were to happen now, this would be a catastrophe. We've seen smaller events cause blackouts, like in Quebec in 1989. That's the canonical example people use. Something like this could destroy satellites, could cause widespread blackouts. We haven't had an event that big since 1859. And in fact, that's when these things were first discovered. That event was so huge that even at the time they could see it. Well, it turns out in 2012, the sun blew off another one of these huge events, and it missed the Earth by about 2 weeks, if you want to think of it that way. If this had happened, I think, 2 weeks earlier, the Earth would have been in a position in its orbit where this would have actually hit us. As it was directed away from us and hit a satellite that's orbiting the sun, and that footage is terrifying. It looks like it was hit by a shotgun. And that's how they were able to measure the strength of this thing. And some scientists have said, yeah, this thing was at least the equal of the 1859 event. And if it had happened, we would have lost satellites. We would have lost power. The internet would be down. And to be honest, as one scientist said, today, 2 years later, we'd still be picking up the pieces.
Mm-hmm. Phil, if it hit, would it hit like half the Earth wherever, you know, the energy was coming from? Like, would it be that way, or would it be more like regional, like in a specific country size?
It would propagate to around most of the Earth, I think, because of the Earth's magnetic the magnetic field or the Van Allen belts.
Yeah, basically, it's there's a lot of regional damage. For example, in North America, up in the northern states and in Canada, the geography and literally the geology underground makes it a little bit easier for this magnetic induced current to exist, which is why, for example, Quebec lost power, whereas other places didn't. So you get specific damage because of the way the Earth is constructed, and it depends on which way the Earth is tilted. So if it happens in the summer, it might the way the magnetic field of the plasma connects with the Earth, it has its own north and south magnetic field poles, just like we do, and it might connect with the Earth better in the North Pole and the South Pole and all this stuff. It could be global. Certainly, these fast-moving subatomic particles slam into satellites and basically create, they generate huge electromagnetic pulses. And that will short out the satellite. And that can happen anywhere in space. It doesn't matter if it's, you know, in the North or South Pole. As long as it's not behind the Earth, you know, it's shadowed by the physical bulk of the Earth itself, the satellites can get overwhelmed by this. Military satellites are hardened against this sort of thing, but it's hard to tell if we would lose some military satellites as well.
You think we could simulate it in a small scale to test devices?
Well, we have. Look up Starfish Prime on the web. This was a nuclear test back in the 60s, I believe it was, without looking it up. And it was a nuclear bomb that went up over the Pacific. And I want to say they blew it up about 900 kilometers off the surface of the Earth, but it actually caused power outages in Hawaii, blew out stoplights, traffic lights, and street lights because of the electromagnetic pulse from this thing. It was really tremendous.
Phil, I think it reached 800 miles in Hawaii from in your blog. I think you mentioned that.
Oh, okay, yeah.
That's quite a distance.
Of course, it's going off the surface of the Earth, and the Earth is curved. The higher up you go, the farther away the direct line of sight is. So Hawaii could have been on the horizon. It could have been, you know, 1,000 or more miles away, even if the bomb were only a few hundred miles up. So the reach of this thing was quite huge, and that was caused by the huge pulse of subatomic particles and gamma rays, actually, from the bomb. So in a sense, that sort of EMP, the electromagnetic pulse, is similar to a coronal mass ejection. I don't know how they would compare. I mean, the pulse from a bomb is very localized. Something from a CME would envelop the entire geomagnetic region of the Earth. But either way, you know, you don't want to be screwing around with forces like this.
Now, Phil, I was trying to figure out, to find some definitive sources, exactly what would be vulnerable. Everyone seems to agree that satellites would be massively vulnerable unless they were really hardened against this type of event. That the power grid, because it's so huge, would be extremely vulnerable, especially the transformers, which could easily be shorted out. But then as you get progressively smaller and smaller, I found less and less agreement and just more opinions, and I couldn't find any really hard data. So, for example, would the electronics in an airplane be taken out, or in a car even, be taken out by this? Or would consumer electronics plugged in? Of course, they could always get a surge off of the power line, but unplugged, you know, would this melt my hard drive?
Well, I will say that I am sure that there are people who know this and could answer your question. These people may not be allowed to answer your question. I can expect that after Starkist Prime, which is when this effect was, I believe it was when it was first seen, first discovered, there were tests specifically for this. And you can generate electromagnetic pulses on a small scale in various ways, not quite like they do in the movies, but it can be done. And I imagine they test this on hardware. The question is, you know, will it happen? I don't know. The direct effects of these things, the subatomic particles, they tend not to get very far past our magnetic field or not really that far past our atmosphere. You need tremendously energetic subatomic particles to slam into our atmosphere and then basically create subatomic shrapnel, I like to think of it, secondary particles that come screaming down in a shower. And those can affect things on the ground directly. But I'm not even sure you can generate that sort of thing with a nuclear weapon. I don't know, to be honest. But either way, that's a good question. And like I said, I'm sure there are government people who know but aren't talking.
Yeah, maybe that's why I couldn't find a definitive answer. A lot of opinions, but they're all over the place. Somebody's saying, oh, our electronic equipment is a million times more sensitive to this sort of thing than it was 40 years ago. But other people seem to think that small devices really wouldn't be at risk. But I couldn't find any calculations, not even like a back-of-the-envelope calculation to really inform it. It was all just naked opinions.
Yeah, I'm not sure how you would do that. I mean, the Earth's atmosphere protects us from most of this. These particles really have a hard time getting through. So you probably wouldn't be directly affected. There wouldn't be anybody who would be dying of radiation poisoning, except maybe astronauts, who are out in space, unfortunately. Down here on the ground, that wouldn't happen. However, secondary effects, power outages, hospitals being out of power, lack of air conditioning if this happened in the summer, lack of heating if it happened in the winter, this could be a real problem. Now, the power grid, you can think of the power lines as being like pipes with water flowing through them, except in this case, it's wires with electricity. When a lot of these things were built, they were built 50 years ago or more, when the capacity, the load was a lot lower. We didn't have that many houses and buildings and such. Now, though, we're running this grid almost at capacity. And if you induce current in these lines, if you add extra lines into them, it's like trying to force more water through a pipe than it can handle. The pipe bursts. And that's what would happen to these lines. And basically, you get these huge transformers, some of which are very large. They're as big as, like, you know, a room in your house. They just get destroyed. And they're not mass-produced. They have to be built by hand. It could take months to replace them. And that's why this is such a problem.
Yeah, what I've read is that the world makes maybe 100 of these a year, those large, large transformers, and has maybe 1,000 of them. So if you think about – and that's at current capacity – assuming we didn't lose the ability to make these things because there's no power,
good point.
It would take 10 years to replace the world supply of these things.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. So it could easily, we could easily have power outages that take years, like several years to rectify.
Yeah. If you think about that, I mean, think about literally sitting down and saying, for the next 5 years, I will not have electricity. Yeah. That's terrifying. The good news is, there are people who have been thinking about this, and what they are thinking of doing are launching a series of small satellites that can detect when these things are about to happen. and you put them in orbit around the sun, then they send us a signal, and we might have minutes or hours, you know, or in best case, days, although that seems unlikely. These particles travel pretty fast. But even so, an hour or two would be enough to shunt power to different grids, to turn things off, maybe even to shut the power off to whole areas, which for a few hours would be a lot better than losing your power for the next year. I like this idea, and I know people are researching it. I hope they can come up with something soon.
Seems like a worthwhile investment.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about trillions of dollars here, more.
But would it be that easy as just turning off our stuff?
Not so much turning it off, but turning off the power at the source and making sure that the power in the power lines themselves is at a much lower capacity so that you have room for the extra electricity to flow through if you need to. Okay. I'm oversimplifying, but it's that sort of idea. Yeah.
So Phil, right now we don't have the probes or satellites in place that could give us warning?
As far as I understand it, nothing really dedicated to this. You could use some of the things we have. We do have satellites orbiting closer to the sun, but you want something that's sort of nimble and that can detect these things specifically. And you don't want to have some astronomer just happen to notice, oh, look, our satellite just got shotgun blasted by subatomic particles. We do have those sorts of alerts up. There's a whole system. In fact, here in Boulder, there's the Space Weather Center, the Space Weather Protection Center, Space Weather Prediction Center. That's it. That's what I get for having to think on my feet. And that's their job, basically, is to monitor the sun, make sure if it's about to blow out something that they can warn people in time. But even if they do, I don't think there's a governmental or electrical system in place that would allow us to do anything about it. And that really needs to be set up, as this 2012 event shows us.
Yeah.
You know, the reason that missed us is because it was aimed the wrong way. There is no reason it could not have been aimed right at us, and we would not be having this conversation right now.
So it's not a matter of if it's going to happen, it's a matter of when it's going to happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's statistically speaking, you know, given enough time, yeah, this is going to happen again.
Well, they're saying what, a 12%?
12% for the next 10 years. That's a really high probability.
Yeah, but the last one was 1859. You'd think we would have had another one squeezed in there, at least in between, but you know, before now.
Yeah, those kind of statistics are a little weird, and I'm not sure exactly how they calculated them. But that's right. There was an astronomer named Baker who estimated the odds the Earth will get hit by something like this in the next 10 years is 12%, right? One out of eight. But it's hard to say. And yeah, the fact that it's been, you know, 160, 170 years, 150 years, whatever it is, kind of shows you that this isn't happening that often. But it does happen. And if we do nothing, yeah, we're basically sealing our fate.
All right, let's move on. Bob, you're going to tell us about a cool extinct type of living critter. We don't even really know if we should call them animals.
Yeah, it's a little controversial, but there seems to be a little bit of a consensus at least. But the idea is that paleontologists have uncovered new fossils of the earliest multicellular life that was big enough to see with the naked eye at least. And the fossils have been known for a while, but they found a new batch of them that were pretty interesting. Now, there's some disagreement, but they may be among the first animals that ever existed. And get this, they were fractals, animal fractals, which is cool. Just so awesome. So they're called rangeomorphs. I think that's how you pronounce that, which is kind of a cool name. They existed in a geological period called the Ediacaran, which lasted from 635 to 541 million years ago. So incredibly ancient. Now that was right before the Cambrian period, which you may have heard of. Now fossilization is sparse in these ancient rock layers, primarily because life forms from that time just didn't have any easily fossilized body parts or like hard shells. And that was because shells hadn't even evolved yet. I mean, that's how long ago we're talking. But it wasn't just shells, though. Most of the structures that we think of as, you know, kind of important for animals, I'm talking things like legs, internal organs, nervous systems, even mouths, were not anywhere on the entire Earth. Yet these creatures were pretty much cutting-edge biotechnology because they were among the very first multicellular life, and they weren't tiny anymore. They were, you know, they ranged from 10 centimeters to 2 meters. Meanwhile, the rest of the world was pretty much single-celled organisms, so rangeomorphs had no competition, essentially. So based on what I've said so far, and if you look at their images, they look like plants. They have these frond-like extensions that look like fronds or leaves.
So it's easy to think that they were plants, but and that would make sense, except for this little fact that they just lived too deep in the oceans for photosynthesis to be of any help. And they couldn't even move, which it makes them even more seem like plants. But with no photosynthesis, then they really couldn't have been plants, not plants that we know of anyway. So eating appears to be something that happened to them, you know, instead of an active strategy on their part. Nutrients that just happened to wash over their membranes would be absorbed. And that actually was not a terrible idea long ago, since the oceans were a surprising nutrient-rich primordial soup, I had to say that, much more so than today. Now, this method of eating, of just kind of passively waiting for food to come to you, would have been facilitated by the body plan of these ranger morphs. Now, you need lots of surface area. It needs to be maximized so that you could absorb the food that just happens to impact you. So fractal shapes are awesome for that. We've talked about fractals a little bit before. Fractals are shapes that exhibit self-similarity. Tiny parts of them look like the whole, which means their scale invariant. So if you zoom in close or pull out really far away, they pretty much look the same way. So these shapes are found all over nature, coastlines, mountains, clouds, lungs. They're pretty much everywhere. And one of the reasons why they can take up so much space is that they have what's called fractal dimension. So they could have a dimension of not just 2, but like 2.5 or 2.6, you know, depending on how close they are to actually becoming, you know, three-dimensional. So they fill up space with incredible efficiency, which is, for example, that's why lungs can be very tiny, but because of their fractal nature, they have a surface area of about 90 square meters. So things were going really well for these first animal-like creatures for millions of years until there was this explosion. What explosion was that, Steve?
Cambrian explosion?
Cambrian explosion, yes. That was a milestone of epic proportions. The fossil record of that period in time shows evolution having this kind of creative spasm. New body plans and phyla appeared for the first time, and so many, in fact, that all the phyla that exist today, except for one, I believe, were found there first. That's just kind of like, yep, I'm going to try all of these different types of body plans, and a whole bunch of them were so successful, they're pretty much still around today.
Yeah, but there were lots of phyla in the Cambrian fauna that don't exist anymore.
Well, yeah, I kind of implied that. I mean, it wasn't 100% successful, but it was kind of like a scattershot. And
most of them
and a bunch of them, yeah. A lot didn't, but a lot did, and they're still around today. So nutrient availability went into a steep decline because they have all these bioterminators from the future that couldn't be stopped. But I also want to end with the fact that it is still a little bit controversial what they were. Most scientists seem to think they were animals of some sort, but there are some that think maybe they were more like algae or lichens. But there's also another possibility, which I find incredibly intriguing, and is that they simply belong to a completely different kingdom of life. It makes me think, you know, what would they be like today if they had, you know, the past half a billion years to continue to evolve. So check them out online. They're fascinating and beautiful, and they might just be the first animals that existed, and they were fractals.
It's also my understanding is it's still not entirely clear whether or not the Ediacaran fauna led to the Cambrian fauna,
you know, yep,
or were they completely separate? You know, again,
right.
were they wiped out by the Cambrian fauna? Were they on the way out anyway, and the Cambrian fauna were filling the gap? We just don't know. I think.
Yeah, it's unclear. It's unclear what the relationship was, whether they were completely distinct and unrelated, or they had some impact on at least some of the new phyla that appeared. Hard to say.
Well, we're going to talk about a different type of animalcule. Jay, I know that you love sharks, and you just love to talk about sharks as often as possible, especially if they're being fired out of tornadoes.
Yeah, well, I did invent that movie, by the way.
Yeah, the Sharknado.
Yeah. I did, which is pretty awesome. I happen to love sharks. I think they're fascinating. I just don't want to be in water anywhere near one that could eat me. That's my relationship with sharks. But the Discovery Channel, on the other hand, has quite a different kind of relationship with sharks. They are completely bilking sharks for all they're worth. They're even bilking sharks that don't even exist for all they're worth. So what am I talking about? We got Shark Week that started this week. And, you know, a lot of people carve out a lot of personal time to watch it. And, you know, apparently Discovery Channel does very well with Shark Week.
They'll put anything on the Discovery Channel.
The opening of Shark Week this week started with a show called Shark of Darkness, Wrath of Submarine. it kind of sounds like caveman talk in a way, doesn't it? So this show is about a 35-foot-long great white shark, and they say the Wrath of Submarine because they're saying it's the size of a submarine. And it also supposedly attacked people off the coast of South Africa, and the submarine shark actually was an urban legend that was started by journalists in the 1970s who were trying to fool and make fun of the public. But what ended up happening was the Discovery Channel's producers apparently heard about that, and they decided that they were going to make a two-hour special about this provable, very easily provable fake folklore. And it's okay, though, guys. Don't worry about it, because they included a brief disclaimer. Evan, settle down. Yep. The disclaimer okay. reads, "Its existence is highly controversial. Events have been dramatized, but many believe submarine exists to this day."
You know, you could put the word leprechaun in there, too. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's so ridiculous.
Its existence is not,
Eskimo.
It's not highly controversial. I have to take apart this sentence, because every point that they make is wrong. It's not highly controversial at all. Because, like I just said, it was absolutely faked in the 1970s, and with a very little bit of research, you're going to find that out. Events have been dramatized. All events on this particular program were not dramatized. They were completely made up. No one is expanding on the truth here. This is a whole cloth, 100% made up. Many believe that submarine exists to this day. Yeah, who? Let's talk to those people that believe that submarine exists to this day. Here we are with a two-hour show that kicks off Shark Week. And, you know, I am labeling this as a two-hour show full of bull shark. Thank you. Wow, too bad Rebecca wasn't here, because she would have loved that.
A bull shark is a kind of
now,
shark.
Now, look, this is what we can absolutely determine from that particular show that they started Shark Week with. It's total BS, and they 100% know it. And you know what? I'll tell you why. They know it because they made up 100% of the show. So they know it's BS because they made it all up. There's not a producer there that doesn't know that they made the entire thing up. So thank you, Discovery Channel. Great science, great education, and thanks for not cashing in. Last year, they started Shark Week, or they at least featured Shark Week, with a documentary called Megalodon, The Monster Shark Lives. Now, minute amount of research here shows that there's absolutely no proof that there's a megalodon living today, that megalodon lived millions of years ago. Not thousands, not hundreds, millions of years ago.
Yeah, it's like saying there's a dinosaur around today.
Right, and just for background, a megalodon is pretty much like a white shark on steroids. It was like a bigger than a bus. What was it, 40, 50 feet long, total meat eater.
Forget about
just,
it.
Just the nastiest shark that ever lived.
Bob, according to Discovery Channel, there's one hunting around Florida, you know, with all the people that go to the beach at Florida, and there's not one legitimate sighting or one death, but it's there. It's there. It's watch ridiculous. It.
I don't know now, what they're smoking.
Yeah, I have to say, I've worked with Discovery Channel. Steve, you said they'll put anything on the air except the fourth episode of my show. but that wasn't their fault. But that's a long.
But you're
story.
Not bitter.
No, actually, I'm not. But you know, I've done a lot of shows with Discovery Network since then, How the Universe Works, and a few others, Science Channel.
Yes.
And you know, when they do good, they do good, and when they do bad, they screw up. And this was a big screw up, just like it was last year with Megalodon. And they really need to rethink Shark Week, because the Discovery Channel and Science Channel, I mean, their brand is reality. It's science. And this is neither of those, and they need
they're destroying their brand.
Yeah, they're destroying their brand. Isn't this one of their high? Apologize for this.
I agree with all that. Isn't this one of their highest rated weeks?
Oh my god,
of the year,
it's gargantuan. It's a cultural event.
Yeah, it's part of the public
megalodon of shows.
Couple more important points to make here, guys. Listen to what they're actually doing. They interview quite a few legitimate scientists, and what they do is they completely scam them. They pretend that they're filming for a completely different show. They ask them a bunch of questions that are loose in such a way where when the scientist answers them, they already know how they're going to use the answer. They're very good at crafting these fake show ideas, and they're asking them questions saying, you know, hey, was that shark really big? And then the scientist goes, yeah, that shark was huge, right? What shark? They take all these comments out of context. They build a fake show out of it. Then they put these poor scientists on the show, and they're like, wait a second, I did a show about X, Y, and Z, not the wrath of submarine. What the hell is this? And that statement I just made wasn't about the submarine.
Yeah, yeah.
So
they took a page from Ben Stein's Expelled.
Right.
That's what I was reminded of here. And that weird geocentric movie that came out where Captain Janeway had to disavow it. Yeah, it was all very weird.
Yeah.
So I hear you, Phil. Look, there's different producers at Discovery, and sometimes they make a good show, and sometimes, like Shark Week, you know, some of it, if not a lot of it, is not good. I mean, if you go back to the beginning of Shark Week when they first came out, I mean, it was real science on there.
Yeah.
And now it's riddled with garbage. You have a lot of students now going and asking, like one of the professors, a biologist, was saying, you know, he's had 500 students come up and ask him about Megalodon. Does it exist? And, you know, no, I'm sorry, it doesn't exist. Where'd you hear that? Shark Week? Yeah, okay, well, that's not true.
And there's so many actual cool sharks to talk about. I mean, it's not like there's a dearth of material here. You know what my daughter Julia's favorite shark or shark-like creature is?
What?
Helicoprion.
What does it do?
Familiar with this guy?
What's it got?
It's an extinct shark-like animal. It's a eugeniodontid holocephalid fish. Sure you guys are familiar with those. Yeah.
It's kosher.
Lived about 310 million years ago. So its lower jaw, the teeth in its lower jaw would come out, and then, you know how like sharks, they get the perpetual teeth that keep coming out? Well, the old teeth would spiral around and inward. So it literally had a spiral of teeth in its lower jaw, which became like a circular saw.
Oh, wow.
Ouch.
Yeah, and it would just, you know, chew things up with that. So, I mean, look it up. Heliocoprion, totally cool.
I like the frill shark. And yeah, in case you're interested, we on the SGU news site, that's theskepticsguide.org/news, we have a listing of 5 cool sharks for Weird Wildlife Wednesday, so that this post goes out on every Wednesday. We put some interesting wildlife on there. So we have 5 really cool sharks on there. If you want to get real information on real sharks, take a look.
And if you have to check out the goblin shark. That is the creepiest shark in existence, and it's alive today. When you see it, you will say, what the F is that? It's just an amazingly awesome looking shark. And at first you're like, is that even a shark? That's how weird it is.
The next news item is a very quick update. We've talked before about cervical manipulation and dissections. A dissection is basically a tear on the inside of an artery. When that happens, a clot could form there, which could either, you know, block blood flow through the artery, or it could, the clot could go downstream, lodge, and cause a stroke. So they're very dangerous. They can cause strokes, even death. In young people, you know, an arterial dissection is actually a not uncommon cause of stroke, because, you know, they otherwise don't have strokes, or they're at lower risk for them. One question has been, when chiropractors do cervical manipulation, does that increase the risk for arterial dissection? Specifically vertebral artery dissection. The problem is there is no definitive data on this. It's the kind of thing that would be hard to have definitive data on, because you can't do the kind of controlled studies, you know, that you would need, which is almost universally true when it comes to negative outcomes. Like, you can't do something to somebody to see if they get a negative outcome. You know what I mean? So it's hard to design those studies. That's the reason, for example, why there are no controlled studies linking smoking to lung cancer. They're all observational studies, you know?
Unethical.
Yeah, you can't say, all right, you people over there are going to smoke, and you people are not going to smoke, and we're going to see who dies first. You know, you can't do that. So anyway, there's recently the American Heart Association and the American Stroke Association came out with a fairly thorough review of cervical arterial dissections and their association with cervical manipulative therapy. Very good, you know, it's a good summary. It's very thorough. And the bottom line is that they conclude that there is an association, between manipulation and vertebral artery dissection. However, a causal relationship is not proven. Then they go on to continue to recommend caution before getting manipulative therapy. I actually thought that their conclusions were overly conservative, and part of it is because they're erring on the side of caution, and there's a few things they didn't consider. One is they put too much stock, I think, in the Cassidy study. This is now an infamous study where chiropractors looked at the association between dissection and visits to a chiropractor. They actually looked at the association between stroke and visits to a chiropractor and stroke and visits to a primary care doctor. And they found that they were about the same. So they said, see, therefore, going to a chiropractor doesn't cause stroke. But it was a terrible study. They looked at older patients. Most of the strokes that occur in older patients are not due to dissection. They looked at strokes without ever determining whether or not they were dissections or not. And they didn't find out what people were getting done at their chiropractic visit. So it was really, really, just sloppy, bad data that didn't directly address the question. We've reviewed the study on Science-Based Medicine before. It's basically a fatally flawed study that does not really answer the question. But if you talk to chiropractors about this, they'll just say the Cassidy study, that shows there's no association. So, and I think that this new review put too much, I think, weight on that study and underestimated its flaws. Secondly, the thing is, yes, you have a correlation here, and correlation does not prove causation, but it can be evidence for causation depending on the type of correlation that you have. Here we have people who go to a chiropractor and sometimes immediately afterwards get a dissection and a stroke. But if you look at it within 24 hours, that was another problem with the Cassidy study. They looked at a much longer time scale. If you look at it over the next 24 hours in young patients, that there is definitely this correlation. It is in the right sequence to be causative. The one legitimate point is that people who have neck pain may go to the chiropractor to treat their neck pain when in fact it was a dissection all along. And that's what the chiropractors say. But interestingly, that's not that much of a defense, because if you have a dissection, the last thing you should do is get your neck manipulated. So saying that, oh, we're manipulating people who already have a dissection, that's hardly a defense. Does that make sense? You guys understand that?
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, mm-hmm. So it was a good review. The data clearly shows an association. There's multiple lines of evidence that show there's a plausible connection there. And taking all of that, here's the thing. In medicine, we look at risk versus benefit. What's the benefit of cervical manipulative therapy? Nothing. There's no proven benefit. So if it's zero, then even though dissection is rare, it's really serious. Stroke and death are bad outcomes. So even though they may be rare, it's not worth it because there's no evidence of any benefit. What the studies we do have show that doing much gentler manipulation, what we call mobilization, is just as effective, although it's not clear that either of them work. But even in the best case scenario, you could get away with just gentle mobilization and without the risk of dissection. But what's incredible is how angry chiropractors get when you talk about this and how unwilling they are to look at the risks of their own interventions.
Well, of course, right? They don't want to hear that they're hurting people.
Bad for business. Bad for business.
They don't have – that's the thing. It's they have a culture of business, not a culture of scientific evidence. Well, let's move on to our last news item. For this item, we called in an expert, so let's go to that interview right now. Joining us now is Renee Ritchie. Renee, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, Renee, you're joining us today just for one issue that we want to talk to you about. You're the editor-in-chief of iMore, which is an online site that is pretty much dedicated to the iPhone. Is that accurate?
It's Apple in general, so iPhone, iPad, Mac, and the related software.
Okay, great. And I understand you're also the co-host of 7 different podcasts?
Yeah, we're going to reduce that somewhat, but that's currently the case, yes.
So, we wanted to talk tonight about this charge that Apple deliberately throttles back the iPhone when a new model update is coming up so that people will feel frustrated with their iPhone and want to buy the new model. Do you know about this accusation, and what do you think about it?
It's been leveled previously. The current version was actually an analysis of big data, and they were trying to show you why correlation wasn't causality, that because people searched for the term iPhone slow, it didn't mean that there was actually anything wrong with the software. It had to do a lot with perception and with just the fact of running new software on older hardware.
So the data was showing that people were searching more on the terms iPhone slow just prior to the release of a new model.
Yeah.
But that doesn't show that it actually was slower.
No, well, a lot of this is perception. So what usually happens is 2 days before a new iPhone is released, Apple releases a new version of the system software of iOS. And several things happen at that point. So first, it gets pushed out to tens of millions of people because Apple has an incredibly unified software ecosystem. And they could be running devices going back several years, so three, maybe four generations. And when those people start to download that, first of all, you have a change. It's like when you buy a blue car. Suddenly, you see all these blue cars. So because you know something has changed, you're paying more attention than you used to. Mm-hmm. But also, when you update, a lot of things happen. For example, iOS starts reindexing everything. It starts migrating libraries. And all of that stuff does add extra overhead at first. But that overhead usually clears out after the first day. But by then, because you're already paying more attention, you have sort of a heightened sense of it. And also, it adds new functionality. For example, in one generation, they added multitasking, application programming interfaces. In another one, background refresh. And all of this takes more resources, and older devices are more resource constrained. Most of them you can go in and shut off, but by default they're on. So on older hardware, you're now running more things, and that comes at the expense of, you know, you can do a few things really, really fast. If you start adding more things, everything wants its fair share of the resources.
But the people are actually making the search. They're doing the Google search for it, and it does, like you said, correlate. However, you're saying it's psychological in that people, this perception that their phone is slowed down is the cause of this. Is that correct?
Yes, it's two things. It's the initial updating mechanism itself. It's the new functionality it introduces, which is a heavier load on the device. But it's also the perception, and especially if there are, you know, fancy new features on new hardware that you don't get, you're already a little bit upset by that. So you might be, you know, more inclined to find fault than you would otherwise be.
Yeah, so it might actually be slower because of the software update. They're not deliberately throttling back the throughput of the phone.
It's an incredibly tough situation because they're caught literally between a rock and a hard place. If they don't provide these updates for people, they'll get yelled at. For example, one generation, when they went to the iPhone 3GS, they didn't provide video recording for the previous generation phone, and people were hugely upset, and they got accused of deliberately crippling the previous phone to force people to upgrade. So when they don't add features, you know, there's an element of the population that's upset, and when they do, there's an element. But more importantly, by providing these updates, they ensure binary compatibility. So if you, for example, they're going to release iOS 8 in September, and devices that don't get that will not be able to run apps that require iOS 8. And that is an even bigger problem than not having new features, because increasingly apps are going to require new versions of the software.
They usually force you to update your iOS, right? I mean, I've used an iPhone and tried to install an app, and it basically forced me to update the iOS before I could install the app.
There's a couple of things that happen there. For hardware that can't run it, it won't force you. It'll keep you on whatever the last version of that software is. For everything else, the iOS is a security-first operating system. Everything about it. Apple published a white paper last year on how elaborate and how, you know, how elaborately they were securing iOS as an operating system. And part of that is providing software updates and security updates. And when you have operating systems that aren't updated as much or don't bring, you know, tens of millions of people with them, then those become susceptible to exploits, whether it's browser-based exploits or apps doing malicious things. And that's not a problem Apple wants their users to have to deal with.
So it sounds like that's a perfectly reasonable explanation for why there's the perception of slowness around the time of an iPhone update. But just to ask flat out, do you think that Apple ever manipulates the performance or any features of their phones in order to encourage people to buy the new model? Or are they just hoping that people are going to want to buy it because it's the latest and greatest new thing?
I think first of all, I think they don't do that, because part of the part of the experience of buying a new iPhone, part of the value of buying a new iPhone is that you know that Apple's going to support it for a certain period of time. And if they get a reputation for not supporting it or for doing anything duplicitous with it, that would no longer be the case and they'll lose that value and people might look elsewhere for their phones. But also because, especially in North America where there's a carrier contract cycle, you know, traditionally it was 2 years and you could basically get a new phone either cheaply or even for free on some carriers. And now carriers have accelerated update programs where you pay a little bit more, but you can get cheaper phones faster. So I think Apple knows that people are going to update their phones regularly. I mean, two generations is not a long period of time. So there's even less incentive for anyone to do that. And just anecdotally, it seems based on prior history that they do everything they can to bring as many features as they can and do as much performance as they can forward. Now, they're constrained in resources, which sounds silly because they're a $100 billion company, but there's only so many engineers, you know, Facebook is hiring, Google is hiring. Not everyone wants to move to Cupertino. There's startup culture to deal with. But they devote as much resources as they can to make sure that older devices get as much attention as they can.
Yeah. There's enough competition from Android that they have to keep their customers happy.
Absolutely.
Now, but why did these you said that this has been happening for some time. This is not a new conspiracy theory. It's been happening for several years, you know, the last few releases of the iPhone and stuff. So, is your work having an effect on people's understanding of what's going on? I mean, or is it just too big an ocean to hold back, in a sense?
Well, I mean, I'm sure it's the same in any area of science where you, and I'm not relating this to a science in any way, but you always have people who are skeptical and you always have people who are inclined to distrust large companies, or to just distrust any point of view or disagree with it. So there'll always be someone coming along. And for example, I think that recent article in New York Times was an example of this because towards the bottom of that article, they state very clearly that this was about big data and about the dangers of mistaking correlation for causation in big data. And that article was widely reblogged as Apple has a conspiracy. And that shows me there's a profound lack of reading going on.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Renee, thank you so much for straightening all that out for us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks, Renee.
All right. Take care.
Thank you.
Well, Evan, it's time to catch us up on Who's That Noisy?
Okay, Steve. And we'll play for you last week's Who's That Noisy, this little ditty that we played for you. Here we go. Right, you guys remember that?
Oh, yeah.
I do.
Now, Steve, you had told me last week off the air that you knew exactly what that was.
I recognized it. Because I've been there. I've physically been there.
And where is there?
That those are, was it the Luray Caverns in Virginia?
Luray, L-U-R-A-Y,
yeah,
correct.
Yeah, Luray Caverns in Virginia. It's a stalactite organ. Those caverns are beautiful. If you're definitely in that part of the country, it's worth a quick stop off to go down there. But I remember that. I remember that they had that, you know, they had the stalactites tuned. To different notes, and it's like all over the cavern. You're standing in the middle of it. It's like all over the cavern, different stalactites are played.
And I'm sure that sound fills up the cavern, huh, Steve?
Oh, yeah.
It is technically the largest instrument in the world, so it holds that distinction. The stalactites cover 3.5 acres, if you can believe that. And it produces these tones when electronically tapped by rubber tipped mallets. It was invented in 1954 by Leland W. Sprinkle of Springfield, Virginia, who was a mathematician and electronics scientist at the Pentagon. Very cool. So he put his vast basis of knowledge to good use here in making this amazing instrument. And I want to get down there sometime. We had a lot of correct answers for this one. Actually, we had a lot of incorrect ones as well. It was a good week for responses. A lot of people thought this was perhaps the glass harmonica, the invention of Benjamin Franklin from way back when. But that was actually a noisy from many years ago. We'd actually already covered that one. So, well done for everyone who guessed correctly. And this week's winner is James Leatham. We drew your name of all the correct ones, so congratulations. Your name will go in the year-end drawing. And we want to send a thank you out to Holly McCall for sending me the suggestion to use it as last week's Who's That Noisy. So thank you, Holly. I do appreciate that. Now for this week, wait till you get a load of this. This is, yeah, I'm going to let it speak for itself because I'm almost at a loss as to what to say here. Here you go. Enjoy.
90% of the psychics working are fakes.
They are.
Well,
yes.
We're the most documented psychics in the world. Mm-hmm. And don't go to a psychic unless they have a proven track record of accurate predictions. Seriously, you'll waste your money.
Well, I agree that you will waste your money, yeah.
Yeah. Don't waste your money on the bogus psychics. Only go to the real ones because 90% of them are bogus. It's 10% are real. Want to know who you think said that. And you have to let us know. Let us know by email, wtn@theskepticsguide.org. That's the email address for Who's That Noisy related items. Or if you want, go on to our message boards, sguforums.com, and look for the link called Who's That Noisy, or the thread, I should say. Who's That Noisy? And post your guess there. Should be fun. We'll reveal it next week. Good luck, everyone.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
All right, guys. We have a couple of quick updates. Actually, one is a correction from last week, Jay. You talked about the Ebola virus.
I did.
Got a few emails correcting us at one point.
I only got one thing wrong on the whole news item. It's pretty good.
Well, I'm not saying that. This is the one that people pointed out.
Well, I got something wrong. Apparently, in last week's show, I said that there was an incubation period from when you catch the virus until when you actually start to show symptoms. And it was what I believe I said, you catch it for 2 to 5 days, and you could not show symptoms up to day 21, I believe, were the correct numbers.
It's, yeah, so the, yeah, 2 to 21 days is the incubation period.
So during the incubation period, you are most likely you're not able to give the virus to somebody else.
Yeah,
you're not shedding in a way that you're going to give it to other people.
So yeah, by definition, you're asymptomatic, and essentially, and I've read multiple sources on this. There's actually some misinformation out there. You know, some sites say that you can transmit it during the incubation period, but I did find published studies showing that when patients are not symptomatic, they do not seem to be contagious. So during the incubation period, it looks like they're not contagious. But I think that some sites were unwilling to commit to the idea that there's no way to transmit the virus while you're in the incubation period, because it seems that as long as the virus is in your system, it's possible to give it to another person. So it's not very contagious, but I mean, I don't think we could say 100% that there's no way to transmit it, when you're in the incubation period. It's just that there's less of the virus around, so you're going to be transmitting less of it in body fluids or with direct physical contact. All right. One other quick follow-up. We talked about The Hobbit last week.
Four Hobbitses.
Homo floresiensis. So I mentioned that, you know, there are essentially two schools of thought. One, that the fossils represent a new hominin species. The other, that it's a Homo sapiens that's either just a pygmy or a diseased individual, a developmental problem. And a scientist published a new study claiming that it was a person with Down syndrome. And although I said, I don't think this is necessarily going to be the last word, not until I hear from the scientists claiming this is a new species that they acquiesce. So in the interim, I did find that there are scientists who are already disagreeing with the Down syndrome conclusion. They're saying that the researchers were cherry-picking features. They were ignoring features such as the anatomy of the wrist, which is very primitive, which can't be explained on the basis of Down syndrome. And therefore, that's really not a good explanation. The authors, like Eckhart, who is saying that it is Down syndrome, are rejecting those criticisms. So bottom line, this fight isn't over. The two sides are sticking to their guns. They're basically sticking to their position. One side saying it's a new species of hominin, the other saying that it's a diseased Homo sapiens. And the controversy continues, and certainly may not be resolved definitively until we find new specimens. That may be the case.
Sounds like an ad hominem attack.
All right. Well, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week? We have three interesting news items this week. No theme, though.
I don't think I've ever gotten this right. Maybe some SGU historians would know. For the, you know, dozen times I've been on the show, I really don't think I've ever been right.
Okay, well, yeah, you know, one more shot.
Even when I've, like, known that one of them was real or something.
True.
All right, here we go. Number one, an examination of certain Cro-Magnon remains suggests that a mummification process was used, not unlike early Egyptian techniques. Item number two, for the first time, a scientist has developed a technique for creating glass out of elemental metal. And item number three, a new study finds that certain rubble asteroids are held together by more than their mutual gravity and that some other unidentified force is involved. Phil, I'm going to go easy on you. I won't make you go first. I'll improve your chances of getting it correct. So, Jay, why don't you go first?
The first one about Cro-Magnon remains in that they used some type of Egyptian-like mummification techniques. I don't see that being that wild. I could see them doing some things that, you know, because this is so unclear, you know, they could have done certain things to help preserve the body. Maybe they found, you know, some naturally occurring plant or whatever. And, I could just see them finding herbs and whatnot that could have done something. And because this one is not that clear, you know, he said it's not unlike early Egyptian techniques. I don't know what the early Egyptian techniques were. I know what the later techniques definitely were. But I'm not crystal clear if there was a big variation between early and late. So that one's a maybe. Okay, so now we go on to number two, and this one is about creating a glass out of elemental metal. If I were to strictly define glass, I'm pretty sure that glass is made out of sand. Right out of the gate, I can draw a line to where it seems like it might just be BS. I'm not sure about this one. And then finally, the one about the rubble asteroids and that there's some unknown or unidentified force keeping them together. I really don't like that. I don't like the unidentified force idea. It doesn't mean that it's a force that has never been discovered or studied. It means that some other force that we're not sure which one it is holding these asteroids together. I'm going to say that the elemental metal one is the fake.
Okay, Evan?
Cro-Magnon remains suggesting that a mummification process was used, not unlike early Egyptian techniques. I don't have a problem with this one, really. You know, the strange thing being that it ties into the same techniques or similar techniques that the Egyptians used, but, you know, how many different kinds of ways can you mummify people? I imagine there are several, but that the earlier people, Cro-Magnons, stumbled upon a way of doing it, and certain Cro-Magnon remains, right? So parts of the body then? Maybe the head or something. So I think that one's going to be right. The one for creating glass out of elemental metal. So my first thought was that how are you going to, my first vision of glass is that it's clear, but I guess the glass didn't have to be clear. Otherwise, you know, how are you going to get elemental metal to come out clear? I don't know if that's been really happening yet in the world of science. So I don't know about that one. The last one, the rubble asteroids held together by more than their mutual gravity. And an unidentified force is involved. I guess the math doesn't work out exactly, that if you just take gravity, there's something missing and therefore whatever it is otherwise unidentified. I don't know about that one. But the one about glass kind of struck me the wrong way. I don't know that they've really figured that out yet. So I think I'm going to lean with Jay and go with that one, that the elemental metal one is the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Let's see, the Cro-Magnon mummification. Yeah, I'm not sure about that. That just seems a little too sophisticated. I mean, I know they were people just like us. It's not like they were Neanderthals. They were just a race of people. So it's not like they had any mental shortcomings to potentially figuring that out. But it just seems like, you know, Egypt had a, you know, well-developed culture that this mummification process grew up in. I think the Cro-Magnons didn't have anything near that. But then again, what do you mean by early Egyptian techniques? See, we got the creating glass. Yeah, I don't have much of a problem with that one. I guess the key fact here is that it's elemental, but I just can't think of a reason why they couldn't make some sort of, you know, what is it? Amorphous, non-crystalline solid out of metal
that would pretty much make it a glass. A glass doesn't have to be glass as we know it. There's lots of different types of glasses. The rubble asteroid, yeah, I could imagine some force that hasn't been identified. It would be cool if it was some effect, like, say, the van der Waals force that we just, similar to that we haven't identified. That's how geckos and spiders can crawl on anything using those intramolecular forces. I don't think it's necessarily that, but that would be interesting if that's true. Probably have some impact on how we deal with asteroids, too, if it's... I'm going to say that something about the mummy one is rubbing me wrong. I'm going to say that one's fiction.
All right, Phil, the three rogues are trying to help you out. What do you think?
Okay, well, I'm going to cheat because it just so happens the rubble asteroids one is the one I know about. I'm the last one, right?
Yeah.
That one I know is true.
All right.
So I'll throw that out there because I have to. My hand has been forced. There's an asteroid named DA50. Or 1950 DA that is spinning so quickly that if it were just a rubble pile, it would fly apart. And so there must be some other force holding it together. The problem is I have only seen a press release and not a paper. But that one is right. So I will push that one aside. Now the other two. For the first time, a scientist has developed a technique for creating glass out of elemental metal. A glass is an amorphous solid, which can go from a brittle state to a liquid, you know, to a gloppy state, in this transition. I happen to know that. That strikes me as being true. There are metals that are brittle under certain circumstances, and I can imagine that if you do something to them, they can become an amorphous solid like a glass. I don't know this one. I have not heard this at all. I expect it is one of these things where it's happening under tremendous pressure, like in the centers of planets or something like that.
Yeah,
I'm guessing that's what's going on. So that one has the ring of truth. The first one, an examination of Cro-Magnon remains suggests a mummification process. That one bugs me because I don't think Cro-Magnon... I want to say that they buried their dead, but they had jewelry and things like that, I think, but it never really got past that. So this idea of mummification, which kind of indicates an understanding of death a little bit more than maybe the last time I read anything about what their culture was like was a while ago. So my memory on this is fuzzy. But that one strikes me as being too much. So I think the glass one is real. The asteroid one is real. And the Cro-Magnon remains being mummified is the fiction.
Good choice, Phil.
All right. So we've got an even split, but you all agree. That a new study finds that certain rubble asteroids are held together by more than their mutual gravity and that some other unidentified force is involved. You all think that one is science and that one is. Now, what do you think the force might be that is holding the asteroid together if this one were to be true?
Dark energy.
Undetermined, yeah.
Let me
I
read
know,
you
nuclear
so
forcing. I don't know.
Wink Martindale.
Let me read you the actual headline in Nature. Near Earth asteroid held together by weak force.
Really? Wait, that's what they said?
This one is true. This one is science.
Oh.
And that
weak force?
That headline caught my eye. I'm like, really? The weak nuclear force?
Not
the weak force.
They don't know what they're saying.
It's a weak force.
A weak force. It's not the weak force.
Yes.
So what was it?
That one is true. So it's 1950 DA, and it is spinning. So it goes around once every 2.1 hours. However, gravity could only hold it together so that it could spin at once every 2.2 hours. So it's spinning a little faster than gravity would allow. It should be flinging apart. So there must be something else sticking the rocks together.
Wet?
And it's weak because you don't need that much. But they make no speculation as to what that is. They know it's a rubble pile asteroid because of its density. Rocks, but it's much less dense than rocks, so it's got to be a lot of air pockets in there, and it has the characteristics that we've come to associate with the so-called rubble pile asteroid.
Not really air pockets. It's out in space.
Well, you know what I mean. Yeah, vacuum pockets.
Yeah, I think they just call them cavities.
Cavities, yeah.
But, Steve, couldn't it really just be some type of liquid that is making things stick together more?
I don't know.
Liquid well, I'll in tell space? You, in, I got a press release about this a couple of hours ago, which is how I knew about it.
Yeah.
And the press release actually says it might be a van der Waals force.
Yeah.
It's like a surface tension.
Like almost like a surface tension.
It's more like surface tension, yeah. And it's what's interesting is they said that, and there's no explanation of it. It just says, the team studied near-Earth asteroid 1950 DA and discovered that the body is held together by cohesive forces called van der Waals forces. But that's it. They just declare that. There's no link to a paper, so I didn't even see the paper.
Yeah, well, Nature has a little bit more. This is not the original paper, but they go into more detail.
Well, the funny thing here is the press release has two errors in it. It says that another asteroid caught by the Hubble Space Telescope is falling apart, possibly due to a collision with a meteor. It's like, no, it wasn't a meteor. It was another asteroid. Meteor is the thing that burns up in the Earth's atmosphere.
Yeah.
And then it also says the Rosetta spacecraft landed on the comet, 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko. It says it landed on the comet surface last week. And it's like, no, it's actually moving along with the comet. It's going to send off a lander in November. So the press release doesn't have the information I wanted and has a couple of mistakes in it. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Don't you think that that was an unfortunate headline choice by calling
held together
it
by
held
weak
together
force.
By weak force? I mean, you use the term weak force, and you don't think people are going to think that's the weak force? We'll go back to number one. An examination of certain Cro-Magnon remains suggests that a mummification process was used, not unlike Egyptian techniques. Evan and Jay think this is science. Bob and Phil think this one is the fiction, and this one is... Now, is it Cro-Magnon or Cro-Magnon?
It's French. It's Cro-Magnon.
Yeah, it's Cro-Magnon. Just like Neanderthal and Neanderthal. Although I've gone back to Neanderthal because I just screw it. It sounds better. But yeah, it is Cro-Magnon.
Cro-Magnon, for sure.
Yeah. So they, Cro-Magnon were fully modern humans. They were, European upper Paleolithic humans, basically from the region of France, around 43,000 years ago. So they're just basically a race, if you will, or a population of early humans. So there's no reason to think they weren't roughly as intelligent as we are. But this one is the fiction.
Yes!
You did it, Phil. You did it.
Well done, Phil. I'm happy for you and Bob.
I also had to lose. Right, Ev? It's good to give Phil a win.
Absolutely.
Did any of you see the actual news item?
No.
Hell no.
So what they did find was... Egyptian mummies about 2,000 years older than they thought they were making them. This is a study published in PLOS ONE. So
that's a long time.
Yeah. So prior to this, the earliest known use of resin for mummification was around 2200 BC or BCE, depending on your preference. And this one they found, these were funerary wrappings from grave sites near the Nile River, called Mostaghera. They were excavated in the 1920s and 30s, but you know, things like this sit around museums for decades and then people decide to take a look at them. They were carbon dated to 4200 BC.
42.
So looking at the wrapping, so not only did the date to be to between, the oldest was 4200 BC, the more recent one was 3150, and then under microscopic examination, they found the linens were impregnated with certain resins, similar to the resins used in later mummification. About 5 to 20% of the blend was made up of pine resin, and they also found evidence that these resins were deliberately heated, which is part of the technique, you know, if you're trying to do it for mummification. So this is essentially, the use of these resins is as like an antibacterial to protect the body from bacterial decay. So part of the mummification process. So the Egyptian mummification tradition goes back a lot farther than we thought.
That's really cool.
That's very cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, huh?
I have to admit something here, and that is I, for some reason in my brain, got Neanderthals and Cro-Magnon backwards. And that's why I thought this one was wrong. I was thinking they were Neanderthals. And Neanderthals.
Got it right for the wrong reason.
I got it right for the wrong
That actually counts, Phil?
I still would have gone the way I did because I still think the metal thing is real. So I'm being honest here. I would fully admit it if I were, you know.
That's funny because when you were describing them, I'm like, that's actually a better description of Neanderthals, what he's saying.
But, yeah, and it's because that's what it was. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. All right. So tell us about metals.
All right, yeah. For the first time, a scientist has developed a technique for creating glass out of elemental metal. That one is very cool science. I love material science. This is also published in This is published in Materials Science. The name of the article is Metal Turned to Glass. It's a single author, Giles Tarjus, T-A-R-J-U-S. And so here's the thing. Glass is not just the kind of stuff that we make our windows out of. It is a solid that is amorphous. And essentially, solids have a tendency to crystallize, right, for their molecules to form a particular arrangement. Metals themselves have a tremendous propensity to crystallize when they cool. So if you melt a metal, turn it into a liquid, and then cool it, it really wants to crystallize. And so far, scientists have not figured out how to get any elemental metal, meaning just the one element, to not crystallize as it cools. They have been able to use a couple of alloys. So they have been able to make some metal glass using specific alloys. If you remember not too long ago, I don't know, maybe a year or so ago now, we talked about actual transparent aluminum. Remember that?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Where they made, it was an alloy of aluminum and other things. I think they actually had sapphire in there. But this was elemental germanium. And Phil, you're absolutely correct that they used extreme pressure.
Aha.
In order to get the germanium to cool without crystallizing, to keep its liquid amorphous structure.
Oh,
as
that
a
does
solid.
Make sense. Okay. Yeah.
What I could not find out though is, whether or not it's clear, it's transparent. It just says it has the properties of a glass, but it didn't specifically say that it was transparent.
I don't know if glass has to be transparent or not.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be because you have.
But if it's a pure substance, I mean, I've got glass here. I've got some Libyan glass, which is impact glass from an asteroid impact in the desert in the Sahara, and it's very sort of milky yellow and green.
Yeah, well, is it obsidian glass, and that's black?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I have obsidian too. And it's gorgeous, but yeah,
obsidian,
you're right. It's glass.
It's cool. Yeah, and the name is so cool, obsidian. Because I love it.
In fact, it was used as spearheads by Cro-Magnon. So there you go.
The Knights of the Obsidian Order.
Yeah, exactly.
I believe Cro-Magnon man used obsidian to ward off asteroids. So that ties all three of these together.
There we go.
All right. So we're all correct in a way.
All right, no. Phil. So congratulations.
Yay. Right for the wrong reason. I will take it.
Absolutely take it. All right, Jay, do you have a quote for us?
Steve, I have a quote sent in by a listener named Joel Stein. Joel is from Redding, California, and he sent me a quote in by George Washington, and here it is. There is but one straight course, and that is to seek truth and pursue it steadily. George Washington!
Yeah, isn't that, didn't you have some story about not telling a lie, about cutting down a cherry tree?
I think that's a lie.
He also stood up in a boat.
No, I hear that's a fiction, too. He didn't stand up in that boat.
Probably everything is a fiction.
It was too cold that night, and he had a big old heavy coat, and he hunkered down like everybody else. But the portrait tells otherwise.
Right. The portrait is history.
Right. Is there any evidence he really existed?
Yeah. Yes, there is.
You still have his ivory teeth.
There's a university named after him.
That's true. And some other stuff. Phil, I got a question for you before we close up the show.
Sure.
Peter Capaldi, what do you think?
I'm all for it. I've never been disappointed in a new doctor. I've always been saddened by the last one leaving, and then the next person comes in, and I'm always like, well, but you know what? They wind up being awesome every time, so I'm good.
Yeah, I think David Tennant is still my favorite. I guess everyone's supposed to have their one favorite doctor. But I'm looking forward to Peter Capaldi. First of all, he's like in his 50s, so he's like our age.
Yeah.
And I think the doctors have been getting too young recently. I think this is a good move.
Well, I was concerned. I wrote about this saying that, you know, if you go from Christopher Eccleston to David Tennant to Matt Smith and extrapolate that, the 13th Doctor is going to be a fetus. So Peter Capaldi, I think, is going to be interesting. And he's also put his foot down and said, no romance.
Yeah, so. I heard that. Yeah, he's not going to have a romance with his much younger companion. Forward to it. This is Doctor Who, by the way, if anyone doesn't know what we're talking about. Well, Phil, always a pleasure to have you on the show. We have to do this more often.
This was fun. Yay.
Thanks, Phil.
All right, guys. Thanks for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Doctor.
Surely, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.